We're honored to have with us this morning a panel of very distinguished speakers for the first general session entitled The Future Global Outlook. So I'd like to get on with our content without delay. First off, we're again pleased to have join us one of the top agricultural economists of our time. Well, at least I think one of the most entertaining agriculture economists of our time, Dan Bassi of Ag Resource Company. This is Dan's third year, and really our plan from the beginning was, okay, Dan, can we make this kind of consistent so you could tell us what you said last year, what happened, and what you think for next year? And it's been great. The other thing that's really good is Dan's office is about three blocks down the street, so he kind of wanders down, gives a presentation, goes back, and gets right to work. So Dan Bassi's with the Ag Resource Company and has been in the commodity business since 1979. In 87, he founded Ag Resource to serve the needs of the U.S. and world agricultural community. Ag Resource is a domestic and international agricultural research firm which forecasts domestic and world agricultural price trends and provides information and research to the gamut, farmers to meatpackers and everyone in between. Ag Resource's research is sold in 81 nations around the world. Dan was raised on a dairy and grain farm in Waukesha. I always get this wrong, don't I? And has a keen sense of today's production agriculture. Please welcome this morning Dan Bassi.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you, Andy, for the very, very kind. He didn't lay some of the ground rules I want to talk about, because agriculture is kind of a cyclic business here. So this morning it's cold in Chicago. Please no snowballs, no shoes, any of those kind of things. I'm not the motivational speaker here today. This is kind of a change in the overall landscape from what we've seen in the last 7 years. So be attentive, look at what's going on. We hinted at this last year. Now things are coming more to fruition. As we go back and look at what I would consider to be the starting points for this year, I want to bring up some highlights that I think really talk to where we are today. Now, food inflation this year is going to rise about 3-4%. We've just updated the data through October. Globally speaking, food inflation looks to be about 3.3%. But I want you to notice what is rising on your plate. Notice this year it is not the starches, this is the proteins. We're looking at global meat production being down 0.5%. Beef prices will gain about 5.4%. Of course, cattle prices around the world, in particular the United States, are at record high. Pork prices up 3.5%, poultry up 5.7%, and milk up 4.9%. So again, it's protein now, the species side, that is going to be the bull drivers of agricultural income over the next 2 to 3 years. The newest country combination that we see. Now, of course, Goldman Sachs about 7 years ago made the famous BRIC comments. Our view today, it's the MIS countries, which stands for Mexico, Indonesia, South Korea, and Turkey. These countries represent what we consider to be the largest new ag markets for agricultural goods, $29 billion collectively versus 23 in our friends in China. And, of course, Mexico, we think, holds the best potential going forward. That's, of course, if their security is addressed. By that, I'm saying all the drug lords from Colombia now reside in Mexico. It's a concern going forward as that country looks forward to building its markets. If you don't remember anything from me today, there's one piece of information I want you to remember, if you haven't unearthed it already. That is, North America will be energy self-sufficient by 2020. Now, the data actually points out, and EAI would agree, that it's probably going to be 2019. This is a really big deal. Think about the 1970s and 80s in which OPEC held us hostage. Think about now North America being an energy exporter. How does this entertain agriculture? Where do we fit in? These are issues and topics that will be discussed. But, of course, fracking, shale gas, and all those kind of things are really going to have a big impact. How will this impact the U.S. dollar as the United States starts to diminish QE3 by tapering? Whether that'll happen in the December or March meetings, I'm unsure, but we would imagine a dollar will strengthen for that. This is also a reason why all your 401ks are doing so well this year. Of course, think about a rule of law a government that is trying to get GDP rates back to 3% and then energy self-sufficiency, it will drive the stock market higher, even though we're at record highs today. Most of my hedge fund clients still believe there's another 30 to 50% to go in the equity markets over the next 3 to 4 years. We believe that U.S. farmland prices, and generally speaking, global farmland prices are peaking and could correct 5 to 35%. As interest rates rise, the question of how much of a dip will depend upon your location and, of course, China's future ag import and trade demand going forward. And lastly, I want you to really understand in today's presentation that the biofuel phenomena, if I will, is now mature. When I say mature, that does not mean we're losing biofuel production. It means that we are looking at stagnation in biofuels demand going forward. Caloric intake now is the bullish risk going forward. And again, we've all had this caloric intake and driver going forward. It adds about 1.8% to global grain demand each and every year. We can meet that in a lot of ways, but it's that combination of both that really provided the big bull markets of the last 7 years. And so from our viewpoint as economists and as we go through all of these numbers, we're now back to where we started, where if you're going to be bullish on agricultural and grain markets, it's going to take a weather abnormality, supply dislocation, or it's going to take something in terms of China becoming a much bigger importer in the years to come. Now, again, remember, China has over 550 million farmers. The last thing China wants to do, of course, is allow a lot of those farmers to move to the urban east because of competition in world markets. So the Chinese are going to be very methodical on how much grain they can allow in, and you're seeing that already with some of their GMO restrictions on some of the hybrids we're now looking at. Moving us along, if we look at the energy growth forecast going forward, I did, again, want to highlight that one point of North America being energy self-sufficient. As you look at this graph, the three countries that lead energy increase to 2017 are the United States, Iraq, and Canada. Now, I bet you 10 years ago, none of us would ever have thought that the United States would be the leader in global energy production, increasing their production in 2.5 million barrel equivalents per day in terms of the global landscape. If you combine the United States and Canada, we are looking at about 5 million barrels additional per day coming onto the global market. That's a big deal, and as I said before, one of the big drivers, we think, going forward. Now, we all know that grain markets have not been doing very well this year. Of course, we had record large production in the United States in terms of corn. We had record large production in terms of grains around the world. This is looking at canola, sunflower, and soybeans. Of course, we then can look at the corn market, and we know that the good times have probably come to an end. Notice that for that past 7 years, corn prices rose from approximately $2.50 a bushel up to last year's drought highs of $8. Now the prices have rolled back in Chicago down to $4, and we think that of that bull market, that trend, as you've seen for the last 7 years, has been broken for three primary reasons, which we'll talk about later in the presentation. And as you can see, corn has been this year's leader in terms of the downside. So a very significant drop in the corn market as we've seen this year. Chicago this morning is trading around $4.35 a bushel. Now, globally speaking, when we start thinking about the world, world grain production this year reached records. And compared to last year when Russia and the United States hit a drought, the world produced an extra 163 million metric tons of grain. That's the biggest increase we can find from 1 year to the next. Noteworthy on this list and where I want your eyes to also look at, because there's a lot of numbers, is that world corn seedings reached a record 176.8 million hectares. For those of you that only deal in acres, there's 2.47 acres in a hectare. So again, a very sizable and interesting year. And when we look at global crop yields, and I'm now looking at the three pillars, corn, soybeans, and wheat, they were record high. So this was a very good year for the grain markets, for the grain producers. The arrows that you see below are what I call droughts of a significant nature to a major producing country. 1988, North America. 1995, also here in Canada and, of course, Russia. 2003, where, of course, the floods have crossed much of the United States, and then last year's drought. So you can see that from time to time, we do have these weather abnormalities, but they tend to occur every 5 to 7 years. So looking at global grain production this year, as I stated, we saw a significant increase, about 147 million metric tons after, last year's record plunge. So again, a sizable increase in global grain production. And when we look at global grain stocks, now combining corn, wheat, and soybeans, this year is going to be the largest since 2010. And next year, we believe there's a real chance that the world will see record supplies and stocks of all three. So farmers have reacted to high prices. Farmers have done what farmers always do, which is expand seedings and go forward. That is what is being reflected on a global basis. Now, as Andy suggested, for the last 3 years I've been coming here and I've kind of been the cheerleader, if you will, for these two factors. We've got rising caloric intake, and then we had biofuels, and the combination of the two provided a very potent market for global grain markets. Heretofore, I'm now back to one. We no longer have the biofuels element. And so what does that look at like from an economist standpoint? Well, if I look at changes in what I call world grain use, you can see what happened in 2004 and 5 with biofuels, that green part of this chart, and how dramatically that increased. We also saw the rise, if you will, to some degree in food in terms of caloric intake. But it was that combination, that big increase of 137 million metric tons of biofuels that really put the agricultural markets in the bullish spot that they've been in. Now notice from 2012 going forward, I still have my growth in what I call food and calorie take. That is still going on each and every year, but biofuels has kind of flattened out. The skew of that line is no longer elevated. It's flattening. And when I look at what the markets were looking at in terms of the need for more acres, in particular corn, we needed at least another 7 or 6 to 10 million acres of corn each and every year. That demand or that market driver is now lost. And it's been lost because U.S. consumers are consuming less unleaded gasoline. They become more energy conscious, if you will. We had we had a program called Cash for Clunkers. The EAI, which is, of course, our energy agency, when we wrote the 2007 energy bill, noticed that they had projected that our wives, our moms would continue to drive those big SUVs into oblivion, and that green line showed that somewhere around 2014, we'd be consuming 150 billion gallons of unleaded gasoline. We now know today that's not true. We are consuming around 132 billion gallons of unleaded gasoline, and it's still pointing downwards. If you looked at the major metropolitan areas, the hottest car today is the Tesla. If you can find one, you should buy it because there's a back order of 2 years, and I'm sure you can double your money by selling it to somebody else. But it shows you the importance of energy self-sufficiency and where we are. Now, the EPA just last month decided that we no longer could meet our mandates on ethanol. And so they proposed dropping them to around 13 billion gallons as opposed to this year's proposed 14.4 billion gallons. It's now under debate. We expect fully that the EPA announcement will probably go forward. And so we are to a point today, and this is a graphic that I've taken from Dr. Joe Glauber at USDA when he presented at EPA. The red line shows what I call the blend wall. Even if the EPA were to mandate higher usage levels, it's the blend wall that we're running into at 10% ethanol relative to unleaded gasoline demand of 130 million gallons. If we this year in 2014 consume 130 billion gallons, 10% of that would be ethanol or 113 billion gallons. That's all we can do. That's about 4.9 billion bushels of corn. So corn, at least from the biofuel side, is flatlined. And if we look at around the world, whether it's our friends in the EU or even to a lesser degree in Malaysia or China, we're seeing that vegetable oil demand is also flattening out for biofuel purposes. So again, I want you to understand, when we talk about agriculture, the first leg of this, what I would call change in structure of the agricultural markets, is that biofuel demand has matured. It's not gone away. It's just that it's stagnant now going forward. The other thing which happened due to high prices has been that we're now starting to see the other big consumer of grains, which is livestock. We're starting to see flattening in world meat consumption. So if I look at those BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which have big increases in demand over the last 15 years, we're starting to see a flattening out of that because of high meat prices. Notice on the bottom where I've got the EU and the US, which are, of course, the big Western world consumers, they too are going sideways or being flat. Now, some of this, of course, is due to rising price. China's GDP is about $7,500 per person per year. But as their GDP rates have gone up, so has the price of beef, pork, chicken, and mutton, to a degree that they cannot afford much more. And so that has helped to flatten out some of their demand. I will also tell you that in this agricultural bull market, I'm now showing you GDP rates of China and India. We had all expected that China would be the big driver, and then it would be followed by a kicker called India. That was a two-pronged approach to get agricultural markets going longer term. Notice what's happening to Indian GDP rates. They're flattening or declining. And so I no longer have that driver from India. In fact, quietly, India has become the world's third largest beef exporter. So much for the Hindu religion. When I look back at the United States, red meat consumption is in decline. Now, I can ask the audience why that is. I'll probably get six or seven different answers, anything from health to, of course, substitution towards disposable income. You know, our big thing as we look at U.S. red meat consumption, it peaked around 2006. We're now down 18 pounds per person. I would argue it's that because most of us are reaching what I call the metallic age. That's where, of course, we have silver in our hair, gold in our teeth, and lead everywhere else. We now, by 2020, will have 16% of the U.S. population, which is going to be 65 or older. The baby boomers have boomed. We're now on the back side of that. And so as we think about it, what our doctors tell us as we get to be elderly, we should eat a third less that's on our plate. So it really gets down to caloric consumption. And so we really expect that the red meat consumption in the United States has peaked and will continue to decline, another key driver for grains. And then when I look at what I call cattle and hogs, the two big consumers of grains in this country, notice how flat we've really become. So, again, I'm going backwards in review because there's going to be a test at the end of this thing. One reason is mature biofuels. Second of all is I don't have any growth, per se, in the meat or red meat sector. Now let's talk a little bit about the world market. World grain trade this year is going to reach record highs in terms of corn, soybeans, and wheat. In fact, this will be the first time that the world will trade more soybeans than corn. A recovery from last year. So the world trade thing is still kicking on. It's still doing really quite well. The problem being because of high prices in the United States, because of the ethanol build-out, I've shifted the trade matrix to other countries. We now find that South America and the Black Sea will trade more corn than the United States and EU. Last year, Brazil was the world's largest corn exporter. And so when I look at non-U.S. corn production, a record 63% of the world came from away from the United States, and it was rising rapidly. In fact, when I looked at exports, and I think you'll hear a lot more talk about what we call the ABU countries, which stands for Argentina, Ukraine, and Brazil, they had 65% of world corn trade last year. Even our country to the south, Mexico, bought corn from Brazil and Ukraine. Now, we are looking for the United States to try to capture some of that, but I want your eyes to go back over this chart from about 2010 and beyond and notice the big build-out of export trade from those other countries. Ukraine is here to export corn for a long time to come. I open up the Russian or the Moscow grain meeting every year in September. I have never seen more corn planted south of Moscow than we have now. They have really found the crop to be desirable. And so the United States' share of world trade, which used to be as much as 60% back in the 1980s, we were the global grain market. When we embargoed grain against Russia, it really had a bite. We are now down to 27%. We will make a recovery this year, but we are down to 27%. So if you think about the United States having normal weather, we don't have a demand driver from ethanol. I really can't build a lot of additional feed residual usage coming back. I somehow have to have prices cheap enough, long enough to buy our export share back in world market. That means we've got to compete against Ukraine and Brazil and a host of other countries. This is a new landscape, and this takes a considerable amount of time for the United States to get its market back. So in terms of my hedge fund client business, what's happened is the picture to the top was 7 years ago when we all thought there was promise in being in our agricultural space. Now that we're not seeing an investable story, and so the money has been leaving. We get data from our Commodity Futures Trading Commission each and every Friday. We plot that data in terms of where they are in the agricultural space, in corn, wheat, soybeans, hogs, cattle, and feeder cattle, and you can see that the money has been exiting our space. Why? They don't see an investable theme going forward. And so where has the money been going? Well, you know it as well as I do. The stock market and your 401ks are at record highs. It's been a very good year. The S&P is up 28% through yesterday. Hopefully, all of you have been involved and invested. This leads us in our firm to what we also believe in commodities is what we call the plateau theory. This is a graph showing you 27 commodities going back to 1947. And what we believe is there are structural events that occur over time that leads an elevation of commodity prices, and then prices stay high for such a period of time that we bring in more supply, and we then go sideways for an extended period of time. The last time, of course, was 72, 73, when we brought in the Russian gold bars, the Russian grain robbery. The grain markets and a lot of commodities exploded, and then, of course, the latest one has been the build-out of ethanol and, of course, energy. Now, if you don't believe me in terms of that plateau theory, let's look at how it applies to corn going back to the Civil War at 1866. So the first plateau was here. Notice from 1865 to approximately 1910, corn prices went sideways. Then, of course, we take the next, which, of course, was from the Roaring 20s to World War II. Corn prices again went sideways. We can do the same for the next vehicle, which is about 20 years. Then about 27 years after the Russian grain robbery, and here's where we are today. Our view is that corn is not going back to $2 or $2.50 a bushel. Those days are past. But could corn get back to $3 or under that? Absolutely, not a problem with that. Do we believe that corn prices will make it much above $5 again? Not unless there's a dire drought. In fact, our forecast for the upcoming year, this year we're forecasting an average of $4.45 a bushel. Next year we're down at $3.85. So harvest lows could come down into the vicinity of $3.25 to $3.50. And as we look at corn ending stocks going forward, notice that this year's corn ending stocks are the largest since the ethanol era started in 2005. And next year, with normal weather, we believe that corn ending stocks could approach 2.7 to 3 billion bushels. That assumes 93 million planted acres. I would remind everybody in the room, all delegates, that this year we did not plant 8.1 million acres of ground because of our spring. Prevented planting. We also have 1.6 million acres that will come out of the CRP. So we have 9 million extra acres to add on top of this year's production, and we only need 13 billion bushels of corn every year to keep stock steady. Just to give you a barometer. So, from our viewpoint, the price skew on corn, I want you to look at this carefully because I think it's very informative. The blue line is the pre-ethanol era from 1977 to 2006. We take, in my business, called corn stocks, We then take usage and we divide them to get what's called stock use ratios. We then plot that to price, and there seems to be good correlative factors. When ethanol started to be built out in 2006 and 7, notice how that corn price skew shifted to the right. That's the red line. And the correlation on that skew is 0.89, the R factor, the R squared, which is very high. So as the ethanol industry was built out, we needed more acreage. The price of corn moved higher, as, of course, we needed to buy acres, and we did have some weather calamities. We would argue now that since the ethanol industry is mature, that corn price skew, the red line that you two see, is probably too high. It's probably somewhere in between the red and blue lines. Tells us that corn prices probably trade within a range of $3 on the downside, maybe to $5 on the upside. But anytime a farmer can see a price better than $5, he better be selling it, unless indeed he expects a very, very dire drought to affect its crop that year. This is Ag Resources' forecast for the next 6 years. What we've taken is we've looked at weather dynamics, we've looked at corn end stocks, and we've looked at where the price should be. Notice that we do not expect corn prices to bottom sometime until 2015, and we expect that price to be somewhere between $3 and $3.50 a bushel. We then expect that corn prices will start to climb. But I've got to alert you that the reason they're starting to climb is because we expect that farmers will reduce planted acreage. Ag Resource and the USDA in their baseline forecast of last March projected that U.S. farmed acreage in the next 5 years will drop 20 to 24 million acres. USDA in their baseline suggested 22 million acres in their estimates of March. I would tell you, looking back in history, which you see in this graphic, that has only happened a several times that we've seen a significant reduction in U.S. cropped acreage. That being, of course, with John Block back in 1993 with a program called Payment in Kind, PIC, and then, of course, the Export Enhancement Program of 86 or 87. The reason we need the kind of drop that we're seeing is because I don't have the demand drivers. Again, biofuel mature. We're going to see some increase in export demand, but it's not enough. The market cannot withhold 14 billion bushel crops year after year after year without some kind of governor. And so that's why USDA and Ag Resource believes that one of the functionalities of the market is to get that fragile land somehow back out of production. It probably will take some government intervention. We also have this year, of course, as farmers look at their fortunes in corn starting to slide a little bit, they've been shifting over to planting more oil seeds, in particular soybeans. Brazil this year will produce a record 100, or Brazil, Latin America this year will produce a record 160 million metric tons of soybeans. Brazil will produce more soybeans for the first time than the United States. United States' share of world soy production has been in decline for a long, long time. This year it will reach a low of 35%. And so where I'm going with this is that when we look at the South American harvest, which will start sometime in the middle of February, global soybean stocks, which are relatively tight today, will move up to where that green dot is, which is the high of the last 10 years amid the abundance of Latin American crops. So if we model where we think that soybean prices should be today, we would say $13.5 to $14 pretty much catches it if we only look at U.S. soybean stocks. But if we start to incorporate corn with a mid to $4 price range, that price drops to $12.50. Corn, of course, is another governor on the soybean market. If I then include where Latin American production will be, and we look at G3 stocks, which is Brazil, Argentina, and the United States, that price drops to $10.50 sometime during the first quarter of next year. If you have soybeans and if you are in the production side of things, today's market is a very good opportunity for you to market some of the crop. The market needs the beans today, not tomorrow. When Brazil starts to harvest, we will have an abundance. So as we look at the landscape, there is pressure on farmers to plant less acres in the United States going forward. We are the high-cost producer, internationally speaking. In Ukraine, I calculate the average production for a bushel of corn is about $2.70 a bushel. Here in the United States, we equate that to around 480 to 485. So when you think about globalization of agriculture, it's important. The big reason why the United States has been so costly is that as we had the bull market in agriculture, everybody's had their hand in the farmer's pocket, whether it's land rents or fertilizer prices or, I hate to mention, seed prices. I didn't say that. Everything has gone up. Everything has gone up. And so we've had this very, other than the financial breakdown in 2008 and 9, farmers have been receiving somewhere, you know, in north of $150 an acre in terms of profitability. Now, you see the line to the right is where we expect that profitability to be next year. Now, again, these are all farmers. These are farmers that rent land. These are farmers that own their own land. This is USDA data. We're looking for, of course, profitability in farming to get back to levels we haven't seen since the mid or early 1990s. A much, much different landscape than where we've been. And so there's going to be pressure points in the farmer. We don't think the farmer is going to have a break like we had in the mid-1980s when, of course, over-leveraged farmers caused farmland values to drop a quick 30 to 40% in a matter of a couple years. This is not a leveraged land type of drop. This is an operational problem. I say that because let's say you and I go to our banker. We're now a farmer. We farm 1,000 acres. We go to that banker and say, geez, Mr. Banker, I'd like to borrow, you know, $1.5 million this year. He says, okay, Mr. Dan, not a problem. Your balance sheet is strong enough. You've had a good track record. We'll allow you to do that. His break-even on corn is 480 a bushel. The market today is at 4. Next year he goes back. His break-even on corn is still 480. The price of corn is 380. And he and his banker talk again. He says, well, I'll allow you to do it one more time. He goes back the third year, and what does the banker say? Why are we doing this again? Why are we losing money? So this is a slow leak. This is an operational problem. This is not something that'll be just a plummet all at once. With that in mind, I put up on the graphic where we think the pressure points need to be on the farmer in terms of cost break even, in terms of producing a bushel of corn. This is an analysis of where it is. Potash prices have dropped 40% in the last few months. Or really since we had our duopoly breakup in Russia. But notice as you look at potash, it accounts for about 3% of the cost of producing corn. Potash prices dropping in half is not going to be a solution to where we're going. It's really land, rental rates. It's really harvest machinery, seed, nitrogen, which we think are the four big components of things that may have to adjust or change in this new landscape of agriculture. So just kind of to review, we think this cycle is different than what we've been in. I'm sorry, don't throw anything at me. We try to be true to our numbers and our work. It's not that I like this story, it's what we see today. And my job has changed for the producer's standpoint from trying him to maximize his farm revenue to now protecting his balance sheet. We are selling crop out as far as 2016, trying to make sure that some of that can happen. I would also tell you that for those of us looking at the farm bill, farm bills now include what I call revenue insurance. That's the stalwart of the farm bill. As prices drop, that does not act as a safety net, or as the safety net that people would like. The target price on corn, going back to the old bills, $2.75 a bushel. So as the corn market declines, and let's say during the month of February, corn's at $4.25, that's not going to guarantee the farmer a profit for that year. So as we look at the wild biofuel industry in the United States, it is mature. There's only one ethanol plant under construction in the United States today. It's not for the production of corn ethanol. It's using cellulosic. Feed residual demand. North American feed levels are low due to years of elevated livestock slaughter. As America age, more of those baby boomers, we think that it's going to be difficult to raise meat consumption. That means we're going to have to be more export-minded. U.S. grain export demand is the lowest percentage on record at 27%. With normal weather, there's going to be pressure for the United States to become more competitive in the world landscape. Outside of today's record soybean trade to China, which of course has been ongoing the last few weeks, the world lacks a bullish demand driver. This is a much different landscape than 2012. And so higher prices now hinge upon adverse weather, because caloric intake is about the same 1.8%. You all can meet that rising caloric intake by an expansion of global yields, trend yields. So I don't need to buy any more acres in. In fact, I now own in a landscape that we believe that acres need to come out of production until we get to the next bullish cycle, which will involve China and rising demand, but we think it's 3 to 5 years away. Sorry about the message. It's just the state of agriculture. I've been doing this for a long time, 34 years. We go up, we go down. This is all part of it. But I just want to prepare everybody. The next 3 to 5 years could be kind of bumpy and a little different than what we've had before. Thank you for your time. Mr. Chairman, I turn it back to you.
Well, we'll make sure and keep Dan up here at the front so that you guys can get him before he gets to the back door. Good presentation. We'll have that available too on the proceedings for the website as you move or for the meeting as we wrap up after this week. Thanks again, Dan. And next, we're very honored to have.